You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This episode was originally released on the 24th of September, 2019. And has been updated, re-edited, and remastered. In the modern era of cryptids, one creature has risen to prominence over the last 35 years, and that is, of course, the Dogman. Its key investigator and author is, of course, Linda Godfrey, whose work on the Beast of Bray Road launched both her and the Dogman to the wider world. Linda joins me to discuss her origin story and the Dogman's, and also to cover some of the strange cases featured in her book, I Know What I Saw. From encounters with hellhounds, strange encounters with people who just don't seem right, a few strange occurrences involving the little people, some phantom black cats, and of course a dogman or two, all make an appearance. A big thank you, of course, to Linda for joining me this week. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Our intro and outro music are provided by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. It's December 1991, and Linda Godfrey gets asked to investigate some strange encounters that seem to be occurring in the small town of Elkhorn. What happened next is something that anybody who loves cryptids is fully aware of.
My guest this week needs no introduction. Linda Godfrey has become one of the most well-known authors and investigators in the field of cryptozoology and mysterious cryptids in the world today. With over a dozen fantastic books under her belt, I am delighted to welcome one of my favourite authors, and in my opinion, the first lady of cryptids, Linda Godfrey. Linda, we're delighted to welcome you to the show at Mysteries and Monsters today. How are we?
Excellent. And how are we?
We are very well and looking forward to talking about your fabulous new book, I Know What I Saw. There's a wonderful quote in the book, Linda, which I'll repeat if that's all right, which just struck me as really striking about yourself and your work in this field over the last 30 years.
Sure.
Which was, I've bloomed where I was planted and I found it rich soil. And I think that's a wonderful quote in regards to how Wisconsin has essentially wrapped its mysteries around you.
Yeah, that's a pretty fair way to say it. And I think I wrote that after a couple of people had written me asking where they could go start looking for monsters. There's a certain island of monsters somewhere that you must find and conquer. And I said, you know, there are things everywhere. I advise starting in your own backyard, maybe even literally if you've got a good backyard. But otherwise, every state has state forests, state parks, state deserts. There's private land. People, if you just let your name out there, people may write you, you know, online. It's just a way to start digging and make your own connection. It's really hard to come in and follow on the connection someone else has made because the people may be used to talking only to them or they may not want a lot of others. But you form your own connections and then you can be right in there and be the first person to who knows what you might discover.
Yeah, I mean, it's always struck me as peculiar because your origin story, as we should call it really, in regards to these cryptids, obviously is very well documented, Linda. And you've just become entirely synonymous with that particular phenomena, but you've not just focused on that. Did you kind of, looking back, do you think it's a natural progression that you've kind of embraced a wider variety of phenomena and sightings, or do you think that once people knew who you were, Linda, they kind of came to you because they'd had a weird sighting, regardless of the fact whether it was Dogman based or not?
I think it's been a matter of both, because I was surprised in the very beginning back in 91, 92 that people not only started immediately writing me or calling me, that those were in the dark ages when we had no internet as we know it now, mm-hmm. and nobody had a cell phone. They had to look up actual numbers and dial them and, you know, put things in envelopes with stamps and mail them. It was archaic, but they were coming to me. And so you knew they really meant it if they went to all that trouble. Mm. And I noticed that not only were they telling me, yeah, I saw this thing too. Don't play fun with this. This was, you know, real. My grandpa saw it, blah, blah, blah. And I don't mean to say blah, blah, blah in a disrespectful way. It's just that if I keep going on and on, it'll take forever. But I was also receiving reports of things that were definitely not upright canines. While there was a super large four-footed canine that walked on all fours and was much larger than the dog man and had different behavior, and I didn't know what to do with those at first for years. Finally have a chapter on them in the new book, but there was also people just, it's like they thought, well, if she knows about those, she must be okay for me to tell my lake monster story or my giant flying bird but looked like a bat story. So it just started happening naturally, and you know, as a man trying to be polite, and also I was interested, you know, I contacted them and found out whatever else there was on the local horizon, and there was a lot. And it took years before I realized exactly how many of those there were. And that's what really sparked, I think 3 books ago, American Monsters, because I wanted to share that depth and height of the numbers and types of creatures that people were reporting. And not necessarily just in Wisconsin by any means, around the whole United States and Canada, and I think I even had a few European tales in there. But it's just, it's a bigger phenomenon than any of us think. It's not related to one species of any type. It seems like where there's one type, you'll find, even if not other cryptids, you'll at least find things like mystery lights or UFOs. It's a weird world, and there's just so much more here than most people ever imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic compendium of creatures and cryptids from a whole range of backgrounds and areas, you know, across the world. But there's one story out of all of the book that struck me immediately, because it's something I've very rarely come across, which is the witness who kind of claims to have come across a group of teenage grandparents.
Yes. that was a new one on me. And it was just odd because it went along with, he started off with a story of a pair of very, very magnificent large dogs that he was out on a rubber-coated running track, and then these dogs came trotting toward him. He could see them from a distance, and he thought it was odd. He couldn't figure out what it was till they got closer, and he realized they were trotting in exact lockstep. Their heads held exactly the same. They weren't veering to the right or the left. One way that dog tracks are defined is that they kind of zigzag all over wherever they're going, because, you know, dogs will sniff at one thing, run over to this, breathe a couple times, go sniff another thing. And these were just going in a straight line, in lockstep, almost as if they were locked in sync somehow. And it was just very odd. And there was no trainer. You know, if you had a pair of very obviously expensive, well-trained dogs like that, you wouldn't just go turn them loose in a park.
Yeah.
If you're any kind of a decent owner. And usually if dogs do get turned loose in a park and they're not used to it, they're like, oh, baby, and they're, you know, all over the place and just exploring like crazy. And these dogs were almost as if they were attached to the rubber walkway. And it was after that one that then he told me that some years before that, he had seen 4 people coming toward him on the rubber track, and that there's something odd about these from a distance. They looked as if they were pretty vigorous as they took their steps. They weren't all bent over or anything like that, but they were not exactly, they were like they were trying to be in lockstep, but they couldn't manage it. They were kind of stumbling and staggering a little bit, or acting like their bodies weren't quite connected with their brains. And that's probably the key section, because what it seemed like was that there were these new young bodies on these old heads that turned to look at him as he passed. you know, and he thought he was in the geriatric ward looking at these men's faces. And they weren't all the same, but they were attached to these four bodies. And it was like they were trying to get in step, trying to use these bodies, learn how to be graceful with them. That sort of thing was what he was getting from it. None of them said anything to him. They just kept going, you know, turned their heads back and kept going. And everybody says, well, that's really far out. But, you know, it is true that at the writing of this book, which was, I think, that this quote was like from 2017. It took me a while for it to get through press. There, I had a quote in this book from a Russian scientist who claimed that he was going to be very soon conducting a complete head transplant, human head transplant. And they've been trying this with other lesser animals and, you know, practicing. And the general rule of thumb that you always hear is in any kind of sci-fi story or space machinery or inventions or whatever, you can bet that whatever's let out to the public is like 12 years behind. And so if he's out there announcing that he's got all the skill and just working out a few of the details to do human head transplants, and this was, you know, some years ago too when it was reported to the guy, it wasn't just hot off the press, there may have been, it may have been 20 years that these things have been worked on secretly in government places, or these days it seems to be the private companies that are really doing the most. But it makes a grisly kind of sense, because let's say that you're getting on in years and you would like to be around a while, but the old ticker's not holding up too well and you've got, you know, warts and all those other things. And so you say, well, let's take my head while it's still alive and attach it to a young body. You wouldn't say attach me to another old body. So, and it wouldn't be the young people necessarily that would probably need the transplant or, you know, have the means to pay for it. So the old heads on the young body makes it pretty, well, the most likely of the scenarios.
Yeah, it's just really peculiar because it's a very striking story. It's not like anything I've ever read before. And it reminded me of a couple of things. Obviously, it's a well-known sort of trope in science fiction that people will often look for. Brain transplants were the big things in the, you know, 50s and 60s B movies. And obviously there's a very recent horror film come out, spoiler alert, if you've not seen Get Out, which is a very similar kind of storyline. But it also reminded me of a famous Men in Black case where a UFO witness was visited by two people. And the thing that struck her was that they didn't seem to be able to know how their body worked. And when reading that story, it was very similar to what the witness described. Everybody seemed a bit jerky.
Yeah, it's like it just was, they were unused to it. It was a new sensation or something like that. And he just let them go on their way and never saw them again. Maybe they decided they needed to stay in their underground compartments or wherever they went off to at the end of their trots down the rubber lane.
I mean, it's a very strange experience he relays, because obviously he essentially overtakes them and then he looks back and they're gone.
Yeah, they just disappeared. Maybe there was a trapdoor in the compartment in the rubber walkway. Who knows? It's really hard to say. But, you know, I spent some time. He hand wrote all of this on many sheets of paper, taking great care. And, you know, it wasn't something that somebody just dashed off without any thought. And he didn't strike me as being anything but truthful to these two experiences. And I decided to include it in the book because it just does go along with urban legends, like you say, the trope of the brain transplant and the idea that we can be built up, our bodies can be built up so we can live much longer. And I always think of Mr. Burns in The Simpsons, you know, there's at least one episode that's completely devoted to that. I should look it up. But yeah, it's just an amazing thing. And I didn't think he was lying, especially when he had two different, you know, if you were hallucinating or something, I think they would have been closer together. Maybe it would have been the same dogs again. And we just, the sight of people jogging on a rubber track isn't much of a hallucination either.
They are very varied experiences that this person's undergone. And I think, like you say, that I think the thing about your work, Linda, is that, and I think this applies to anybody that's brave enough to come forward with an unusual experience of any nature in the paranormal or in regards to cryptids, is it takes a lot of guts, I think, regardless, for anybody to kind of even email somebody like yourself and say, mm-hmm. I've seen something terrifying that I simply cannot comprehend.
Mm-hmm. Right. I hear that a lot. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the one thing that always kind of gives credence to some of the more outlandish stories. And obviously, I think for yourself, being primarily a journalist, first and foremost, your methods are ingrained in your ability to investigate these experiences.
Well, I think that's true. You know, a lot of people say, well, you published this story, you know, and then right away you went out and started writing books and to make a career. And that's not true. I got this story published, and then I worked for the newspaper for another 10 years. And during which time I was also teaching art part-time and doing commercial art for a commercial art firm in Milwaukee. So I was pretty busy, but I got done with the 10 years, and I loved the newspaper I was writing for, but being in a small town area, you find yourself writing about the same person two or three times, you know, and I just couldn't do another thing on, you know, the fall offerings at the opera house or whatever. Mm. So, and the other thing was that all during this 10 years, people had kept writing me, and I was developing quite a stash of incidents, and I'd been putting them occasionally in, I think I maybe only did four of these, just some catch up type of short articles saying, oh, the beast's back. And just to, and people would always respond to those. You know, that was the sort of thing that kept it going. At one time, I put all of it in, and this is true, I don't often tell this, but I put all of it into a big box and carted it over to the Elkhorn Library and said, wouldn't you like to have a nice display of all the Beast of Bray Road related writings and things like that? And I was thinking, well, you know, they're much more better equipped to handle all the phone calls. Well, they really got overburdened on trying to lend these things out and take phone calls and stuff. So they gave them back. And I thought it was kind of like, you know, the curse of this thing that sticks to you. You know, like you go in the cave and you find a strange thing and then it sticks to you. And so I thought, well, if I write the book, everything I know is in, and all the good stories, the best stories that people have sent to me, everyone will be satisfied and they'll know about it. They'll know what it is, and that'll be it. And so I thought, well, I'll write the book. But I also knew, trying to be very cagey here, I didn't think that the press that I wanted, which was a really, really well thought of Midwest regional press, I didn't think that they would probably go for it right away. And I'd had one other story during my 10 years at the paper where the whole Sunday edition sold out completely. And that was a story about a whitewater that's maybe about, 15 minutes from Elkhorn and Bray Road. A whitewater woman who in the 1920s had a love affair with a college student boarder at their house. And the two of them managed to do away with her husband with strychnine and would never have gotten caught, except then she decided to kill her four children too. And it just went into this almost crazy scenario. And it was just unbelievable. And I discovered that everybody had suppressed it. No one had written about it since she was convicted back in the 1920s, because it was considered so salacious to think that she was doing things like, he was a vet and he was supposed to have two large glasses of cream every night for his diet. And so she would just take off her dress and she'd be clad only in her night shift or her slip. And she put the two big glasses of cream on a tray and she would carry it up the stairs to give him his nightly cream. And that it was just, somebody wrote that in the newspaper and they were saying, shocking, you know, horrible, terrible woman does this and that. And it was to the point where they could not even get any women to sit in on her jury for when she was tried. So it was just completely forgotten. And I was fascinated with this whole story. And there were also lots of coincidences. For instance, the local district attorney who broke the case was a fairly close relative of my husband. His name is Godfrey, and he was the local DA at the time. He later opened a law firm that I think is still going. And he was the one who figured it out. And I mean, I don't want to go into this too much, but it's bizarre. It makes a great tale. I'm surprised nobody's made a movie of this one.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing about killing the children. And yeah, she was the type of person that she didn't even use her own car to she had planned an auto crash for them. She sent them out in the country to buy potatoes and had it planned. She gave them each a big bonbon filled with strychnine, and their ages like 4 to 16 had the 16-year-old driving. And her plan was that they'd eat the strychnine when they got going in the car. And then what it does is it's a horrible death. Whoever ingests the strychnine has all your nerves and tendons turn into knots, and it's completely painful. And you could not drive a car without having an accident. And so the thing happened, the 16-year-old, being a 16-year-old, gobbled the whole piece of candy at once, and it was going to happen too soon. But somehow the 13-year-old managed to get the steering wheel and got his brother to the doctor. Nobody was killed, but that started the investigation. And she tried to say there was a candy selling lady from Milwaukee that came all the way out to Elkhorn and Whitewater and was selling poison bonbons to the children. You know, so I mean, it just got more and more ridiculous and crazy. But it's a great story. And if anybody's interested, it's called The Poison Widow, A Story of Sin, Strychnine, and Murder.
Mm.
I'm not sure if it's even available other than on used book things now. But anyway, it jived really well with the publisher because they specialized in historical true crime.
Yeah.
They really liked it. And then they said, well, what have you got next? And that's when I said, well, would you believe werewolves? And I didn't mean werewolves really, but I knew nobody would understand it if I didn't use that word. And I explained everything that happened and how the creature acted and what happened with the people in the town and all that kind of thing. And they said, yeah, go for it, you know. So that was what got the book actually into the total national consciousness, I think, the phenomenon. The book got the phenomenon into more people's heads and made it a little more popular than I think it would have been otherwise. So, and you have to keep bearing in mind, by the time that book got published, I think it was 2003. So it was a while, you know, before it got out there. And then once you have a couple of published books, that's often a key for everything else to begin happening. People find you and then call you to talk on radio broadcasts and all that kind of thing.
Mm.
So it really is just something that grew out of other things I was doing. And I continued to be curious about it. And that's all it took, because then people would write to me and just this, till now it's this bloated thing walking like Frankenstein's monster, you know, is how and it surprises me. It's growing its own memes too. You know, there are lots. It took a long time before people would admit that they were interested or that it could be anything more than a snouted Bigfoot. But once it caught on, the last 3 or 4 years, there's been like an explosion of websites and Facebook sites, and each kind of has its own take on it. And so you get other variations on it that I never heard from witnesses, but hey, maybe somebody else actually did. So
yeah, I mean, you do say in the book, and I think this is quite crucial in regards to what you've just alluded to there, Linda, the phenomenon you dubbed the Beast of Bray Road could be considered modern folklore in the making. And I think in the realms of cryptozoology, because stories of lake monsters go back centuries to the original indigenous peoples of the Americas, the same with Bigfoot and Sasquatch and Wendigo, tales of little people, they are entrenched in all what we would consider folklore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think along the Dogman, probably along with the Chupacabra, is probably the most well-known that has sort of really come to prominence in the latter part of the 20th century and into the modern day.
Yeah, it's surprising. It really is to me. Yeah, along with Bigfoot. It's kind of funny because I constantly get people writing me with questions like, if Bigfoot and Dogman had a wrestling match, which...
Oh, brilliant. Well, why not? That's a question only you can answer, Linda, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, they're showing up on all kinds of pop items. For a long time, it was just the Bigfoot, you know, and the other ones were in the background. But people give me all kinds of wonderful little things. And I have socks now. Somebody's given me Bigfoot socks, Beast of Bray Road socks, and I think it is the Chupacabra socks. So, you know, just I'm waiting to get my Loch Ness Monster socks. So
get the whole cryptid range. I think there is a money spinning idea that has been missed, I think, by many a researcher, Linda.
But they're coming to it. They're starting to see, you know, Dogman and Bigfoot sell. So. And you know, I will say one thing real quickly here too. You know, there's a part of me that the former cartoonist, well, I guess I still am. I mean, I really started all this so I could do cartoons for the newspaper. But that part of me just loves that there are Dogman socks for people and you know, that Bigfoot is used to sell sausage links and that kind of thing. The humor isn't lost. But on the other hand, many of the people, and I really try to keep respect for the witnesses uppermost, many people feel that when they have seen one of these creatures, especially at close range, it's almost a religious experience for them, not in a worshiping kind of way, but in an otherworldly sort of way that often changes their life and the way they think about things. And they'll say, you know, my life is different now because not a day goes by but that I don't think of that thing. And they often will use the word thing for either one because they just aren't sure what they saw.
Is it? I've asked a couple of my other interviewees this question about their particular field, Linda, and you refer to something quite interesting there about when these people have these sightings, it's akin to a religious experience. When I spoke to Dr. Lynn Keatai, who's synonymous with the Phoenix Lights phenomenon, she's, in her experience, found that people that have experienced a UFO seem to undergo some kind of change in their outlook towards the planet and themselves and their lifestyle. Have you found that people have had that kind of reaction to this experience? Or is it something that's not really mentioned?
Yeah, it may be something that's not mentioned a lot. A lot of people still keep that within them. You know, they feel that there are parts of their experience that are private, you know, and they won't talk about. But I have known some witnesses have had some trouble in their marriages. It's very, very frequent that if, say, two or three friends are out and they all see it, but other ones will talk and have no problem. It's a wide variety of reactions. But I do often feel that there's this sense of awe that changes people a little bit inside. And I don't want them to think that the only value of their descriptions of these creatures and what they went through is that they're going to be portrayed on candy at Halloween or people in dog man masks or, you know, they're going to be treated in some other light way when it really could be that there's nothing light about these creatures or whatever they are that people are seeing at all, because we don't know what they are. We really don't.
Yeah, I think it's that fear of it being trivialized, essentially,
right,
isn't it?
That's in a nutshell, yeah. You said that very well.
Well, thank you. but it is, I mean, it's a very similar kind of phenomenon, you know, as you referred to lightheartedly talking about socks and things. But Nessie has been put on all kinds of things. I mean, you can even buy a wonderful soup ladle, which is shaped like a lake monster, which I think is fabulous. And I know there's a wonderful podcast called Monsters Among Us, and as part of that they do something called Cryptid Crate, and you can every month get a box of cryptid related goodies, which includes things like socks and ties and grow your own Sasquatch. Just really, it's really lovely little gifts that people have made. I think it's fabulous, really, that there is that kind of offshoot from all these wonderful creatures and experiences.
And artists who are selling prints. I've been asked to sell either my originals or prints of a lot of the drawings that I've done of the creature. And I have a very bad trait for an artist, which is I don't like to sell my originals. So, and I'm not that keen of a businesswoman, you know, that I have got it set up to. Maybe the prints eventually, but it's a whole different area of this phenomenon as a whole, is that it's perceived in different ways by different people. And I've had some magazine and newspaper articles done on me lately, and I could tell when reading them, they were, well, let's see, one described me as a short, quiet woman.
Damned by faint praise there, Linda.
And then the next one was somehow somewhat grandmotherish, but eerily pleasant, as if somebody who writes about these things should be unpleasant. You know, like I'd come on your show and say, hey, how long I'm going to take, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, why shouldn't I be pleasant to people? It's generally much easier to worm information out of them if you are pleasant than unpleasant.
Yeah, I think it's that assumption that if you deal with the macabre or the strange, you have to be macabre and strange.
Yeah, and it's actually, I find it's the opposite. The more normal I look, the more willing people are to confide and trust me, you know. And I know I've had, I was out one time doing a library talk, and there were some young teenage girls obviously kind of waiting for me, and I walked in and I'm just my usual, you know, nothing strange about my clothing usually unless I mismatch something. I give into the arty side once in a while, but I think they were expecting a full out goth. And one of them said to me, "Gee, you look like you could be somebody's mom." And I said, "Well, I am." You know, I'm people's mom, and it's great. So yeah, that's something that it's just very interesting to me to see what people expect and how well their expectations are met by meeting me and by hearing the stories of all these witnesses. And the witnesses are generally not any, you know, you wouldn't pick them out of a crowd just by their looks. They're very diverse bunch. They're just people going about their business. In most cases, there may be a slight preponderance of large guys wearing camel, but I don't know why that is, but otherwise it's just normal people doing their thing, driving, going out to the back 40, whatever. And so they're not dressed in costumes like they're part of a play or something. They're just, it's their real life.
That is that one of the things that's extremely striking about a lot of the reports in a lot of your books, Linda, is the normality of a situation that is suddenly transposed to what you could say is a different dimension. Because from normal pursuits, like you say, people driving, people having a walk in the woods, people out swimming, all kinds of things, people playing ball. I think it was one famous case with the two children who see the creature come out of the cellar, which I think's in Monsters Among Us.
Mm-hmm.
It's that often makes the story more striking, is the mundaneness of these people's situations at the time.
Right, exactly right. Yeah, and what you mentioned about the children too, that's another thing that quite frequently occurs, is I'll get letters from people telling me their experience that was 5, 10, 30 years ago. And they all say, "I remember it clear as day. You know, I can still, you know, smell the musky odor and see the sunlight glinting on its ears," you know, that kind of thing. And I have memories from being quite a young child that I can corroborate with my mom and when she was with us and brothers and sisters and that kind of thing, where I know that I was very, very accurate.
Mm.
People who see something like this, you know, it has to impress them deeply. And people say, "Well, it's just a kid. They can't remember." Well, yeah, I think that they can in many cases and do. And of course, who better than to be present for a monster, because children are outdoors playing, they're running to the edge of the property, they're playing hide and seek, they're doing all kinds of activities that might interest a nearby predator, and they're out there more than, you know, they're not burdened usually with, you know, the washing the clothes and washing the, you know, the mother's inside cooking and taking care of the house. The kids are running amok or sneaking out at night, having a cigarette behind the barn, that kind of thing. And so that puts them in a good position for when these things are out there.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing about childhood as well, Linda, is that even if you've not had an extraordinary experience, such as some of the stories that are in your book, we all have memories of being very young children. And we have, I think that because of that emotional response, it becomes ingrained in our memory of whatever it was. I mean, my earliest memory is getting a toy scooter when I was 3. And I still remember that because I sent my family barmy at 4 in the morning on my birthday, going round and round the front room. But that has been completely corroborated by my mum and obviously my grandmother before she passed away. So I wouldn't dismiss any experience simply because it happened to someone when they were a child.
No, not at all. And I think for most people, the long-term memory switches on somewhere about age 3. And that's where I can go. I can remember an upstairs flat I lived in with my parents and baby brother and sister. I can remember what the wallpaper looked like. It was covered with ivy leaves. I can remember the layout of the apartment. I can remember my mother prodding me to go over and say to my dad, who was lounging on the front porch, "Are you comfortable?" And I couldn't figure out why she wanted me to say that to him. You know, I thought about it for a long time and never took me long. I had to get much older before I figured it out, because he was looking so splayed out there like he had just conquered the world or something. But just funny little things. And everybody could tell you the same sort of stories. And so if you saw something that looked maybe reminded you of a bear, but you knew it wasn't a bear and it was tall and it was looking at you and its eyes were glowing, what would you, you know, how would you forget that as a child?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it is crucial for these people to come forward, because a lot of them, they've spent a long time in their lives trying to reconcile what they know as adults to what they saw as a child.
Right. Yeah, that's really true. And they also feel they can't tell anybody else, because most people try telling one person or their family, and they just get laughed out of the room and they go, "Well, I'm not doing that again." So often people will, when they contact me, what they say is almost verbatim, which is that I only wanted to tell someone who wouldn't think I was crazy. I just wanted to say it to somebody. I don't care, you know, if you tell the world or don't tell anybody. I just wanted to tell one person who wouldn't think I was crazy.
I think that is the big fear, because if you can tell people who at that point in your life are probably in some aspects the only people you know, the people that you love completely, and they just tell you that you're being silly.
Mm-hmm.
Why on earth would you then want to tell complete strangers?
Right, exactly. And I think that's, people can sense if you're really wanting to hear the stories, if you're genuinely interested in them and their experience. And I always say, I can't always guarantee that what you saw is what you think it was, but I'm almost never convinced that they didn't see something. And that's more prevalent with photographs than with stories that are spoken. Photographs, oftentimes you can know that you're taking a picture of something. You know, maybe there's a hen in the tree behind the shed, and you take a picture and the hen looks like a big blob of white. You know it was a hen, but nobody else looking at that picture is a hen. Well, a lot of people have pictures of what they say they saw Bigfoot, or what they think was Bigfoot, or the dog man or whatever, and took this picture, and there can you see there's this wing, and then there's this dark thing that must be the beak. Well, you can't fairly expect people who weren't there to identify something that isn't identifiable.
Yeah, absolutely. Very true. And I think it's one of those things. One of the good, well, not that none of the chapters aren't any good, but one of the other chapters that jumps out. Sorry about that. One of the chapters that really jumps out to me is the one that collects the variety of stories regarding little people, which I think is another phenomenon that seems to have dropped out of favor in the modern era.
Yeah, although I think it's coming back. You know, I do seem to get from starting at 0% to every, you know, maybe a couple of months, which isn't a lot, but it's a lot more than it used to be. But there, you have to be kind of careful, because when you talk about people, say, "Well, talk about the little people." And in our society, that term has been used for, you know, very small humans in our society that are, they're human, they're part of the society in every way. They're just, you know, maybe 3 feet tall. I know Colonel Tom Thumb was like 27 inches tall. And had a wife that was the same size, and yet they were fully human, you know, in every way. They were just, it just shows you how small the actual human body can get. And I'm sure there have been times where there were people who had this mutation or whatever causes it, and did live in the woods and would be glimpsed sometimes, and people would presume that these were fey folk, not real. But I do think that there are other times when these little human-like creatures do show up, and then they vanish, and they do give evidence that they at least belong to maybe something that's more like a spirit class of beings. And it's hard to sort them all out, because there isn't as much material on modern contemporary sightings. You know, I mean, I've got books 4 inches wide in the binding on the fairy folk of just the British Isles.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's just everywhere, everything, every surface in that area, to me, from reading it, is just, you know, covered and smothered with these but people do occasionally see them, you know. And then there are some that are just spirit people. There are these little round rocks called concretions up on the shore of Lake Superior that the native people from around there believe spirits, little people, spirits inhabit them, and that they can come out sometimes of the rocks, you know, and display themselves. So there's a real variety of them. But again, the idea that there are these people who are much, much smaller than us, whether they are actual humans or some sort of other sentient being imitating humans, is just endemic to the planet and civilization, and back to as long ago as we know anything, you find these this idea that there are differently sized people, and it's kind of, the flip side is the giant stories.
Yeah,
and they're most often I think today thought of as being relics of long ago, but again, almost every civilization has its giants. It's just really well known. Today, the giants tend to be the really big Bigfoot in most cases. You don't find too many people claiming that they're seeing the, 9-10 foot giant people. Although I also have to say, what were often considered to be giants in some of the burial mounds that have been dug up around the United States, different places, and other countries and spots too, because they were so much bigger than bodies buried with them. Because back, if you go back to, I'll use the Bible because it's maybe better now. If you go back to Bible times, I read that the average height of a man in most places in biblical times was around 5'5", maybe 5'7". Hmm. And then there were all these giants that are talked about. And the Bible goes to great, great detail describing exactly how tall they were, and in cubits. And Goliath, the one that David dispatched with the rock, was I think at least around 8 foot tall. Yeah. I read not that long ago, and I was just really struck by they had measured and weighed each of the plates that he wore on his, tied to his shin, the shins of his legs, and it was like each one weighed 125 pounds apiece. It wasn't pounds, of course. It was their. I'm just saying every part of him was minutely measured, because hand-to-hand combat to settle scores, instead of having the entire armies go to bat and get killed, they'd have two real big champions, and they were constantly trying to know what they were up against, you know, so all these things were really minutely taken care of. And you find in North America, you find burial mounds that contain people of this size, of the 7 to 8 foot size. But, you know, we've got pro basketball players out there all the time that are that size or very near to it. Mm. And you go back in history and look, and I think there were a couple of 8 to 9 foot men who worked as guards in, I'm thinking it was in London, for one of the monarchs. I'd have to go look it up, but they were pretty much, venerated. They were looked up to, and, you know, both the very large people and the very small ones could be in, and many, many different walks of life and were respected. Now there are legends about known little people. And it's kind of funny because they share, one way I determine what I call an urban legend is if it's the same scenario that's just at a different place with slightly different people, but the same, doing the same thing and outcome. Yeah. One of the most loved legends in Wisconsin is the Haunchies.
Yeah.
And if you read that one, and it's one of my favorite, they're not cryptids, you know, because they're not animals, but it's one of my favorite unknown creature names, the Haunchies. I've never been able to find out where that exactly came from, but there's supposed to be a colony of them on this lake near Milwaukee. It's called Mystic Lane, and that was actually always the road's real name. And the legend goes that there were a whole bunch of small humans who had worked for a circus. And Wisconsin, by the way, is very, very linked into circus lore. There were many circuses that stayed over the winter and bought summer homes, you know, especially over the southern part of the state. And so the legend goes that this group of small people retired from one of the circuses and built this little community where the houses were sized for them. They didn't have to make do climbing up onto countertops to get into cupboards because they had everything made small. And to discourage, they had a system to discourage curiosity seekers. If somebody came around trying to snoop where they were. They lived supposedly behind this cornfield. And if you got too close, a man driving a black pickup truck would come charging out of the cornfield at you, and he had a shotgun. And if you didn't get out of the way, he'd start shooting. And if that didn't do it for you, then all the haunchies would arm themselves with implements of agriculture, like shovels and rakes and things, and come rushing out of the corn at you. And if they got you, they might drag you back into their barn where you'd be hanged and your shadow would be imprinted on the barn wood forever. And so this is the local legend. And I've been there, and I've seen some little structures that maybe at one, they're kind of tumbled down by now, but they look like maybe they could have been houses at one time. But unfortunately, the area where their little village was supposed to be has now been turned into suburban lots. And I think the cornfield is gone too. But, you know, I've had people, one just as respectable as the other, write me long letters saying, well, you know, I know about the haunchies. They were not real. So-and-so made them up. And another one would write in and say, I have to say that I saw these buildings. I've seen several of the small humans. It's absolutely true, you know. And so it's just a matter of which do you believe? Well, my thoughts lie toward the reality of the circus thing, because if I don't know if you're familiar with Barnes & Noble's Weird U.S. series. And the haunchies are in the Wisconsin one, by the way. I co-authored that and made sure I got them in there. But the editors of the book have found they're from New Jersey, and that's where it started out, with Weird New Jersey. And there's a colony there. There's a colony in Florida and several others where it's all the same thing. There are these small houses. They were reputedly built by small people who wanted to get out of the limelight and have their privacy, and they come up with ways to keep people away.
How peculiar. I mean, it is something that, you know, as you refer to, it's ingrained in the environment in the UK. Whether you go to Ireland, Wales, Scotland or England, there are stories across the whole range of little people. I mean, near where I live, there's an estate called Longshaw, which is in the Peak District, and they've got a long tradition of what they called boggarts or brownies, who were little people that would live in your house and do your chores for you if you looked after them. Mm-hmm. And they liked a saucer of milk and some biscuits left on the hearth on a night, and then in the morning when you got up, everything would be nice and tidy for you, but woe betide the household that mistreated their boggart, to say the least. But that's all over where I live, and even now they do a little trail where you can go and look for the boggarts and where they used to live. It's a lovely sort of romantic idea, but I think some of these stories, their essence is, like you say, in regards to those stories in the States, there's always a kind of maliciousness or a mischievousness to the majority of these stories. Yeah, tricksters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the trickster side. I had a letter from an American woman who went to London maybe 6 or 7 years ago, something like that. And she was riding one of those double-decker buses, you know, kind of all eyes, being a tourist, looking at everything. And she saw movement on the second story of one of the old buildings they were going past. And she looked and she said it was a fairy. She didn't know how else to describe it. It was dressed in like a light tan colored velvet textured outfit. And it was just sort of poised on the outside edge of this building. It was kind of climbing up a little bit. And unfortunately, the bus was going too fast that she didn't get more than a brief look at it. But my husband had surgery not too long ago, and he had some pretty strong painkillers.
Yes.
And he was taking them, and I'm not telling this to be Debbie Downer on it or anything.
Yes.
But
yeah.
I believe that there may be some sort of a film or a filter in us that we have when we're born with it, little children, and then it goes away, and also the filter goes away when you're strongly medicated too. And you may see something like what my husband saw, because it was like the next day and he went to take a shower. And he said he's standing there in the shower, and this little being comes twinkling through. He said it reminded him of like Peter Pan style fairy, Tinkerbell.
Except
more realistic. He said it was absolutely real, and the wings were more like a dragonfly wings, you know, than what you would expect. And the little person had picked some kind of a purplish flower and was holding it out to him, and he felt obligated to give it applause. He was kind of standing, feeling foolish, standing in the shower, clapping for this little thing. And he's thinking, whoa, that was really crazy. And before he got out of the shower, it came back again from the other direction. So he saw it twice. And my husband is not the type, not the type for any of that. But he said, you know, if you had asked me, I could only tell you it was exactly real. It was as real as the soap in the shower or any other thing. And I think that we do that. This is just my own theory. I do think that there's a veil, if you will, that we're born with, and then that just has to get subjugated as we get older in order for us to deal with regular life. Because babies and children are often seen, you know, pointing and laughing and playing with somebody in their crib. That's why you see so many children with invisible friends. My husband had one. Her name was Mrs. Hen. I never had one, but I don't that I remember, but so many children do. Or you see your dog and your cat looking at something in the corner and wagging their tail when there's absolutely nothing there. I think animals retain or don't have a grown over the way adult humans do either.
Yeah, very true. Strangely enough, my niece, who's almost three, came. Well, she didn't come on her own to visit me over the weekend. She came with my brother and his wife. But she was through at the bottom of the stairs and she started waving. And we said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Oh, I'm just waving at the ghost."
Oh, yes. They see this thing.
Now, we've only been in this house about a month now, and I've always considered myself quite sensitive to things like that, Linda. But to say her jaw just dropped because she just kept looking at me. And my niece mentioned it four or five times through the rest of the afternoon.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And it was just made me chuckle that you referred to it. But it is quite interesting. And I think one of the other stories that I've only recently sort of come to learn about is the Pugwudgie. And I've kind of picked up on that by watching. There's a documentary on Prime that's called The Bridgewater Triangle. And there is a section in that that deals with people who claim to have had encounters with this mysterious little creature that lives in that area.
Yeah, and these are often found. The Pukwudgie idea is found often among Algonquian-speaking Native Americans in the U.S., but also others. But I found the most of them there. And they're kind of like little people of the trees. You'll often find them near a brook. I know of someone who has a pretty good, what looks like a pretty good picture of one sitting by a stream. He's shown that in a video. But they're generally sort of benign, but you shouldn't look one in the eye because they find that challenging. And if you don't pay it proper respect, you know, it'll come back and tie your sleeping bag in a knot or worse, you know, just do something to you. So you're supposed to treat it with respect. If you want to, people will leave out an apple or something like that. But they are very much thought to be alive and living to this day. And again, a very ancient concept.
And I think that's quite interesting when you look at probably the most well-known new addition to the pantheon of these little creatures, which is the duende, which, for everything I've seen, seems to consist of a small creature that tends to run around Argentina terrifying children.
And oddly dressed.
Yes, they seem to be dressed like Jawas from Star Wars, I think is the best thing I can think of.
Yeah, there's just odd dress. And yeah, they're used as sort of, what I've read is they're used as sort of boogeymen, you know, that mothers will say, don't go in the jungle, the duende will get you. And I think it's kind of a cool name, but they seem very closely related to the Pukwudgie and all the other types. Hawaii has their own too, whose name is escaping me right at the moment, but it's the same exact way. And then also there are supposed to be miniature Sasquatches around as well that I don't know if any of them have their own particular names, but people have claimed to have seen them. And then the argument is over whether they are their own species or they are a baby Bigfoot. And, you know, it could go, I mean, if it's anything like the human race, you could get such a variety of people who are still, we're all still people, we're all still humans. There's no such thing as different races, really, because we're all Homo sapiens, you know, and that's it. But if there was a one of my favorite science fiction books, actually, there's a whole series of men, these men who go out into space as ambassadors. And I can't think of the writer's name, but I have owned as many as 20 at a time. And, and he goes around and is an ambassador of the human race, meeting other types of beings in a diplomatic way. And he said he was used to them all looking the same when he was traveling with these other one group of space aliens looked rather like lions. You know, they all had the same mane and everything. And he said he felt so heartened to be greeting a ship from Earth, where he looked down and he could see, and it was nothing to him, but all the aliens were so astonished at how different all these humans looked, because there were some that were very short. There were some that had protuberances in the front of their uniforms, that some that had long hair, some that had a very, very short dark hair, some that were, you know, had big wide faces and they could see their teeth. It's just the whole panorama of humanity is just this incredible DNA, just the riches of DNA. But when you can see the human race has that many varieties, or dogs, we've made dogs as different from one another as we are, that it's not surprising when you see these other things, whether they're what we would call natural animals or just shadow beings imitating us and other natural animals, that you think, well, why does everything have to get written down and given one definition, and that's what they are forever? There's just the universe is so teeming with various life forms. As a matter of fact, I was going to tell you this just for some strange reason. I was just before we went on the air, I thought I'm going to lie down and put some eye drops in. And while I was, and they're not hallucinogenic eye drops either, but but for years and years, I write fantasy novels too. And I've been trying to think of the most original alien look that no one's ever thought of before that would work in a book like this. Mm. And about 2 seconds after I laid down to put with my eye drops in, I thought of it, or it came to me. I don't know what happened, but, and I'm not going to tell it because then, of course, it's so good that everybody will steal it. So just kidding. But no, it did astound me. It is something I've never seen. And I read a lot of science fiction, never seen or heard anything like it, but it's somewhat plausible and it's really different. So if I can think of things like that, I'm sure they're out there, and we could fill books and books and books with unknown creatures and where they live and what they do.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me because to be fair, I think the only major cryptid that there are reports of a slightly different version of it is the Yowie, which is the Australian equivalent of Bigfoot. And there are numerous reports of one being around 4 foot tall.
Right.
And differing colours. They seem to have quite a range from the Yowie witnesses I've heard and read about. So it wouldn't surprise me that there would be. I think you call it short scratch, or that's where it's been sort of given the name of these days. And why wouldn't it? As you referred to, you made an excellent point in regard. You look at the simple variety of not just humans but dogs as well. It would be weirder that there weren't varieties than right. All being similar, if that makes sense.
Right, and we keep uncovering them. You know, what they call the hobbits now, the Florentians islands. Yeah. They were found and they were like, 3 feet tall or so. And it was, at first, it seemed to scientists, they were saying, well, they were probably stuck here without food and that's why they ended up here. And I think the latest thought is that, no, that's their size, you know, and they just were that size. So, and it's a good thing that we were made to have this ability for diversity, because the Earth, if you're going to inhabit the entire Earth, you need a diversity of creatures to withstand the various weather things. Although people don't understand quite how adaptable animals can be to various habitats either.
Absolutely, unless you live in Florida and then you realize everything likes it there.
Especially alligators and pythons.
it's every time. I mean, there seems to be every time I read a story about something new being discovered, I just as soon as I find it's a weird creature, I think it's going to be in Florida, isn't it?
Yeah. If you don't own weird Florida, by the late great Charlie Carlson from Barnes and Noble. That's a good one to pick up. You'll really enjoy it if you like weird Florida things.
Yeah, very much so. So, I mean, the other striking aspect I liked about the book, I'm not very well informed about the American sightings of these creatures, Linda, but that's what you would call hellhounds. But obviously, there's another striking chapter in the book that refers to hellhounds, which I wasn't aware of was as numerous a sighting in America, because it's traditionally an English and a European story.
Yeah, one thing I seem to be getting reports of, I won't say they're super frequent, but they're more frequent than they used to be and frequent enough to surprise me, are sort of phantom black dogs, very, very much like what you'd see tales about in England and Ireland and I think Scotland too. And except the ones I'm getting reports of, they're huge. They're like twice the size of a normal dog, and their eyes are glowing red, which is not the normal eye shine color for canines. And they're usually not, a few of them are standing up, most of them are on all fours, but they're huge. And then the weird thing is, the people call them shadow dogs or shadow wolves, because the creature will turn around to look at them, and they're looking at it in what appears to be a two-dimensional manner. They can see the whole thing from the side, but then when it turns around, there's nothing to it, like turning a piece of cardboard towards you. And I've had at least three over this past year or so, which is a lot from one small area, a story or two in some of my former books. But yeah, and then there are very much like it, what I call the dire dogs that you might have noticed in that book as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, the story that stands out in that particular section is the wonderfully named Spook Pooch. But even where I live in the UK, we've got so many different names for them. It's an unusual experience because they just seem to defy logic in how they look and how they act.
Right. Yeah. Like the gyre trash and the black shuck. I know I often quote Jane Eyre. The novel Jane Eyre has her walking along the moors, and she sees this black thing bounding toward her, and she thinks it's going to be a gyre trash. It's mentioned, right? It's part of the novel, and then she finds out it's just the big dog. But yeah, there's one, I can't think of where it was or the church, but there's the really famous incident where one of these huge black dogs burst into a church and then killed most of the parishioners that were sitting in there worshiping. And I can't remember.
I think that was Barwell.
Yes, I think so too.
16th century, yeah. It's still got the claw mark on the wall.
Yes.
In the church.
Yep.
Yeah. It's wonderful. We've even got one over here that's called the Shug Monkey, which is essentially a dog with a monkey's head.
Oh. Maybe it was getting the same treatment as those teenage old men.
Yes.
You know, in the Ohio rubberized trap.
Yeah, that's one's from the sort of Cambridgeshire area, and it's goes back two to 300 years, and people would occasionally have the misfortune of coming across this terrifying creature in the dead of night wandering lonely paths.
And yet there were good, great canines in the British legends too. I remember there's one of the saints, he wore a grey monk's cowl, and he, whenever he was in danger or he was walking alone late at night, this great gray dog of some sort would come and walk alongside him and guard him, you know, and get rid of any intruders. And there are some people who believe there are dog men that have kindness and that sort of thing built into them. They do act terrifying very often, but the thing is, in the 27 years that I've been recording these, of all the ones that have come to me, I've never had anyone where they were really severely injured, other than one man was kind of nipped on his side and flank while trying to get past one of these animals, which appeared to be trying to get past him too. But normally what they do is they look at people, they may scare them, they may growl or whatever, but they almost always just dive back into the underbrush or the river or whatever kind of thing they were hiding in.
I mean, that's the thing as well. I think it's notable in a lot of the sightings you have covered over the years, Linda, that people say that the creature doesn't seem to act threateningly, but they get the feeling or in some cases almost a telepathic communication of threatening.
Right, that's That's true. And they say it's not like it's in the Queen's English, but they'll just get the feeling that it has just communicated to them that if it wanted to jump on the roof of their car, it could, or that it was better than them somehow. And they'll say, I had the feeling that it was super intelligent, much more so than any normal animal, and that it was as interested in me as I was in it. And that's what freaks people out. It's not so much... Most of the time they're in their car or whatever, and it's not lunging at them, and they don't feel like they're about to be eaten, but they realize they don't know what it is. And that's the truly terrifying thing, because humans are built to figure things out. Mm. We need to know what something is if we're looking at it. And when we can't do that, it's very disconcerting.
Yeah, very much. Well, like you say, it is that it staggers your belief and everything you understand about the world around you when you experience, regardless of what the phenomena is, when you explain something that you can't explain.
Right. And that's another factor in people just kind of withdrawing into their shells about it, because they actually, not only are they afraid of people making fun of them, they can't explain it themselves. Or if they can, like I think, well, it really must be such and such a thing. Then they do feel like they're going bonkers. So it's a complicated thing. And I often think I probably should push for people not treating it lightly. On the other hand, you just can't help thinking about who would win in a Bigfoot dogman match. But I don't ever mean to be insensitive to the people who've had these experiences.
Yeah.
Because it's very real to them. And I actually have seen what I can't explain as anything other than Bigfoot myself. And I didn't tell anybody. I didn't run out screaming about it. It took me a couple of years to get my nerve up until actually this book. And I finally thought, well, you know, how honest am I if I'm trying to encourage other people to share their experiences, but I'm not going to share mine just because I'm afraid I'll get made fun of and people will say how convenient she writes books and then she sees them, you know, but I did. And I would be lying if I said that I didn't.
Well, I mean, to be fair, it's probably because of your work that's got you in a position that you were able to have that experience, Linda.
Probably true. And also probably true that I'm more open to, you know, if I see something that looks like it's a big black log that wasn't out there in the field the day before, I'll slam on the brakes and back up and then be very concerned because I can't see where it went and it should still be in view. Mm. Most people just say, oh, there's a big black log, because you're not tuned for it. You're not expecting it. Mm. You're going about your business. And most of the time you're driving home from work, you're thinking about having the pot roast when you get home. You're thinking about doing this and having to mow the lawn, whatever there is. You're not scouring the sides of the road for things that look like Bigfoot or wolves on their hind legs. You're just not.
No, exactly. That's the thing. It's the mundaneness of ordinary life, which is punctuated by the extraordinary.
Right, exactly. If we lived in a landscape where it always looked like a painting by Hieronymus Bosch, you know, with craziness just everywhere, and then we're supposed to pick out a lone little werewolf-looking thing in the middle of it, nobody would notice.
And I think that probably takes us to the last subject I think we'll cover today, if that's all right with you, of course, Linda.
Sure.
And that's something that also, once again, has parallels in the UK, but also Australia and Canada, and that's mystery big cats, and especially ones that tend to be black.
Yes, this is something that you know, I'd written about these things for the Weird Wisconsin, Weird Michigan books, especially Weird Michigan. But since everybody knows that there are such things as mountain lions, you know, there's no dispute. They are very elusive. Scientists will even call them ghosts of the prairie or spook cats or things like that. But they're only sort of kidding, because they know at the end of the day we have, well, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands, killed back around the early 1900s for their pelts or to make new human communities safer. So we've got the goods on that. But there are not supposed to be what people call black panthers. And there are tons of them that are being seen right now, and officials won't usually admit it. And they're notoriously difficult to get on a trail cam, although you can get the regular tan kind fairly easily. But tomorrow, as a matter of fact, I have an appointment to go examine a patch of land in southern Wisconsin where two men saw a black, they said it was larger than an ordinary mountain lion. It was a huge cat. Mm. They weren't very far from it. It was daylight. They said the daylight, the light was just shining on its fur, which was black and shiny, And it was just leisurely walking with that powerful catwalk, you know, the shoulders kind of lead and bellies are kind of near the ground. It crossed a field and went into a marsh as they watched it go. And I'm going to go there and interview them and photograph the area and all that kind of thing. But that was the second. I had another completely unrelated one about 8 miles east of Bray Road 2 days ago. There was a tan one from a woman who saw it from about, it was only about 60 feet away from her bedroom window. And she watched it for, you know, probably a good half a minute or so and was quite convinced of what she saw. Mm. And these two sightings are probably no more than half an hour away. And there have been others, you know, so I find myself, I think it's because of the documentary that you mentioned earlier, and we have a trailer up there. Return to Wildcat Mountain is the name of that, and we're going to actually be screening somewhat shortened versions of it, half-hour versions of it. But we have so many wonderful, believable witnesses, and you can't help but be respectful of them. They just know what they're talking about, and they say some of them say it right on screen in their interview. I know what I saw, and that's why the publisher picked that title because they think it's just a very another on top of I just want to tell someone who won't think I'm crazy is I know what I saw. They make a pretty good pair of expressions. And we've got people with PhDs that were part of the Florida Panther Project. We have retired sheriff's deputies and policemen and all kinds of just great citizens. So it's very interesting.
Yeah. And for me, obviously, America, you know, you have some notable large cat populations in sporadic areas of the state, so that and you know, in certain areas such as New Mexico and Texas, there has been an influx of cats crossing the borders and finally being captured.
Right.
I don't find it beyond the realms of any possibility that that could be happening in the states at all.
No, there is absolutely no question. And the one I talk about in the book, I Know What I Saw, is in Hillsborough, kind of west central part of the state, where there are rock cliffs and deep valleys. It's very good cougar country. If you ever saw a river, a couple of rivers go through it. And a former newspaper writer and editor has been recording these. There are well over 150 just from people who signed their names to it. We know there are many, many more. But the stunner is that half of the sightings are of black, melanistic, mountain lion-like animals. Mm. And sometimes people will see a black and a tan one together. They'll see them with kittens. That means there's a breeding population. And that's what there's really, you know, because it's well admitted that, yes, well, sometimes some of them make it from the Black Hills around the Great Lakes and go get run over in Connecticut. Yes, that can happen. But there's no breeding population. Mm. Well, that can't be true because people are seeing them with kittens.
Yeah. I mean, it baffles me as well, because we all know just how reclusive big cats are, because even in modern television, there's some extremely famous footage that the BBC got of snow leopards.
Right.
And it took 5 years to get that footage.
Yeah, they can so well elude a camera. We had a black lion sighting at the home of one of the town's barbers, right on the outskirts of town. It was just within the city limits. He was 20 feet from it, and the thing was just, you know, kind of lounging through his yard. And, oh, yes, well, yeah, that's the astounding thing. And the thing is that the witnesses, again, are this hugely diverse, conservative farmer community, lots of Amish people, not anyone you think would be running around trying to make a hoax. And so many of them see it close up in daylight that you just can't deny it. And, you know, again, it's baffling to the officials, and they need, for them to take any serious interest, they need fantastic trackways or footprints, or preferably up close camouflage cameras that have taken really great photos of them, which are not in great supply. But anyway, I've been taking my own trail cam up to this barber's house and putting it different places in the lawn, hoping this thing will go through again, because his next door neighbor also saw it. And who lives right on the side of the, just across the limits from him. So it's obviously got a path through there, and we're hoping it comes back and lets us take its close up very soon.
Yes, well, let's hope so. I mean, have you come across people that have claimed to have evidence such as scat or hair samples, Linda, that they've sent off that has been told, oh, no, you're completely wrong, it's a dog or whatever?
Oh, yeah, that happens quite often, yeah. And it is hard to get good scat to collect and send into someplace. I actually tried. There was a family that had a Bigfoot clomp through their yard and tear out part of a flower planting and eat all the flowers and bump its head on their trellis that they were building and stuff. And it had used a concrete block as a toilet, you know, the kind that have kind of a hollow center, and had left quite a bit of content in there. I finally found a lab in California that said they might analyze it for me. And they said, but how long was it in the shed in that concrete block? And I said, well, over the summer in Tennessee. And they're like, I don't think so. Nobody here wants to make contact with that. So it has to be a good specimen.
Yeah, I would suggest that may have been a little bit too ripe.
Yeah, exactly. But the one that made it from the Black Hills all the way to Connecticut and then was hit by a car was followed by tracing its droppings and doing DNA testing on them. So if it's fresh enough and recognizable enough, you know, I guess it can be done, or from fur samples too. Yeah. And then you, if you have the fur, you can often tell with it by the structure of the fur or the hair follicles with a microscope. You don't even need the DNA.
Absolutely. I mean, I mentioned that point, Linda, because there's a very famous incident that happened on an Australian program called Animal X. And they went into the Australian outback because of the there are stories out there of mysterious big cats, because obviously there are no big cats in Australia's history. They're a modern invasive species fetched by settlers.
Right.
So they actually had heard the story that people were sending in samples and being told it was dingoes or roos or anything but a big cat. So they went to the local zoo and they got some lion poo, and so you knew they'd got big cat poo, and they sent it to the laboratory and the results came back dog.
Interesting.
And then they sent them the footage of what they'd done, and they refused to participate anymore in the program.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. it's on Prime. I think it's called Animal X, and it's really interesting because there's a biologist there who's completely skeptical till that happens.
I think I was on one of their episodes once.
I think you might have been, actually. I think they did do I think they did do one about the Bray Rats about 15 years ago.
Yeah, that would be about right.
Yeah. That fact, you're probably right there, Linda. You've jogged my memory again, because I watched the series a couple of months ago, and it's just...
Yeah, it was a good series. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah. So, listen, it's been absolutely fabulous to have a chat with you today. I want to thank you again for taking the time to fit me in to your schedule, Linda.
My pleasure.
Where can everybody find your work and keep up to date and get themselves a copy of your wonderful new book, I Know When I Saw?
Well, I have links to most things at my blog, which is just lindagodfrey.com. No W's or anything like that, just lindagodfrey.com. And you'll find an about page, which has a list of books. It's woefully in need of updating, as always, so I need to update it. But it has all kinds of links. There are stories that are not in the books. There's a calendar, again, in need of updating, but I plan to do that. It's been kind of crazy since that last book came out, because I've just had piles and piles of requests and other things going on, but you'll find it all there. Also, if you were intrigued by my mention of my one sci-fi novel that is published, I've got the sequel's about half done. There's another tab called God Johnson, and that's what that is. So there, everything you need. There's a place that you can write to me. There's a box if you go in the about page has a box where you can send a message if you have something you want to report or whatever. So it's pretty much the keys to the kingdom are at lindagodfrey.com. I am on Facebook too. Linda S. Godfrey is my author page, and I tweet sporadically.
I think most of us do these days, Linda.
Yeah, it's just too hard. Who can keep up with all of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And when's the film being trailed out and looking for release?
Well, we're hoping to have a showing at the Van Meter Visitor Festival in Van Meter, Iowa, which is coming up the last weekend of the month. It would be the 28th in Van Meter, Iowa, just a little bit west of Des Moines. And then for sure it's going to be you'll at least see part of it for that one. And then for sure it's going to be at the Charles Dickens Horror Festival in Denver, just a little bit north of Denver. And that is happening on the 19th of October. And again, it's the Charles Dickens Horror Festival. So we'll see. We should see the completed version of it by then. We keep getting more stuff, and it's so hard to confine. You know, if you interviewed Seth, you probably heard about it. It's just hard to put the smallest amount possible and tell the strongest story.
Very true. Very true. Well, listen, the very best of luck with it, and continued success with all your fantastic work. And it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today, Linda. So thank you again for your time, and the very best for you in your future.
The same to you, Paul. And it was great. I enjoyed it. Thanks so much. And to all your listeners, thank you very much.